Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Hannah Arendt. Arendt is one of the most renowned political thinkers of the 20th century, and her work has never been more relevant than it is today. Born in Germany in 1906, she published her first book at the age of 23 before turning away from the world of academic philosophy to reckon with the rise of the Third Reich. After the Second World War, Arendt became one of the most prominent and controversial public intellectuals of her time, publishing influential works such as The Origins of Totalitarianism, The Human Condition, and Eichmann in Jerusalem. We are joined today by Samantha Rose Hill, author of the 2021 biography Hannah Arendt and the forthcoming collection of Hannah Arendt's poems. You can find her writing, interviews, and lectures and contact information at SamanthaRoseHill.com. Hill is interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Well, Samantha, thanks for being with me here today on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm excited to talk about Hannah Arendt with you. First, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into this sort of work and writing the biography and researching Arendt?
Thank you, Nate. It's a pleasure to be joining you on this podcast. And, you know, it's interesting that you call it work. One of the questions my students often throw at me is whether or not Hannah Arendt would have considered this kind of intellectual labor work or labor. Does it add something lasting to the artifice of the world, or is it a kind of useless pursuit of labor that doesn't lead to anything that will stay behind? I think it's probably a bit of both, and I hope it's more work than labor in a certain way. But I came to Hannah Arendt almost 20 years ago now, which is kind of surreal to say, when I was in college in Michigan, and I stumbled across The Human Condition in the library one afternoon. I was reading a lot of Marx, as 18-year-old college students do, and I went to the library looking for Erich Fromm's Marx's Conception of Man, and I found The Human Condition, and that kind of changed the course of my own intellectual trajectory, and I fell in love with her prose style. It was unlike anything I had read in political philosophy, and I had been reading Nietzsche, Marx, Locke, Plato since I was like 13 years old, very, very odd kid I was. And this was just more like poetry than prose to me. And I wanted to know what was going on. I wanted to understand what I was reading. And I was very aware of the fact that I did not understand anything.
And that's why you read, right? To understand and
read, yeah. and write. And so I took 9 directed studies in college to read nothing but Hannah Arendt and her antecedents. And then I went to graduate school to do a PhD in critical theory. And I wanted to initially write my dissertation solely on Hannah Arendt. And my advisor told me on day one, I'm not going to let you write a dissertation on Hannah Arendt. So I wrote about Adorno, Theodore Adorno, Walter Benjamin, and Hannah Arendt, which was my compromise. But that, and then I spent the last 6 years at the Hannah Arendt Center. And so it's been a long journey. It's been a long journey up to writing this biography of Hannah Arendt.
That's great. I love to hear that. I love the you describing your sort of reading, you know, one writer to the next. Is even you outlined the way Arendt did that in the biography, which I think is an interesting parallel. I think maybe now is a good chance before we get too far in. Is, I know you wrote a whole book about her, but could you give our listeners a quick little short biography of Hannah Arendt, just to give them some context?
Sure. Who was Hannah Arendt? It's a great question. You know, she is one of the most famous political thinkers of the 20th century, and her books are selling 30-fold right now. And a lot of people don't know who she was. They know that she wrote about evil. They know that she wrote about the emergence of totalitarianism in the 20th century. But then you start to dig into her life, and she has this incredible cinematic life story that is really beautiful and resonant and touching. You know, she was born in Hanover, Germany, in 1806 and lived in Hanover, Germany. And then when she was very young, her family moved to Königsberg, which was the capital of East Prussia at the time, because her father was dying from syphilis and he passed away when she was 7 years old. And she was very inward as a child, but she was also very rebellious. She was always her own person. And I really try to emphasize this in the book, or I'll draw it out at least. You know, she was kicked out of school when she was 14 years old. I think about 15, for leading a protest against one of her teachers because he offended her one day in class. And that was on one of the days she deigned to go to school because she skipped most of the time. But she was very autodidactic. She had read all of Kant by the time she was 14. She knew classic Greek. She knew Latin. She was reading Carl Jaspers' Psychology of Worldviews, who she would later go on to study with. And so she was always very curious. She was very hungry for experience. She wanted to understand the world. And she describes this as a craving, kind of being trapped inside of craving. And then she goes to Berlin. It's the heyday of the Weimar Republic. She finishes up her pre-college studies there to take her Abitur exams, which is what you need to pass to go on to college in Germany. And then she goes to study with Martin Heidegger at the University of Marburg when she's 18 years old. They fall in love. Mm-hmm. there's no way around it. He's the passionate romantic love affair of her life. He's 35, married, two kids. And he is one of the fathers of German existentialism. And he was just beginning to write his masterpiece, Being in Time, when Arne arrived, and he later described her as a muse for that book. She ends the affair. She goes to study with Husserl, who had been Heidegger's doctor father, one of the great phenomenologists of the 20th century. And then she goes on to the University of Heidelberg to write her dissertation on concepts of love and Saint Augustine with Carl Jaspers, the other father of German existentialism. So she has this incredible education. She's studying with the philosophers of the 20th century in Germany. She publishes her first book, her dissertation, when she's 23 years old. Just didn't know. Yeah, that always makes everyone kind of roll their eyes at me. It's fine. And then she goes to Frankfurt. Her husband's writing his habilitation. She's starting to write her habilitation, second book, to secure a teaching position in Germany. And that's where she encounters the Frankfurt School for a year, Adorno, Paul Tillich, and others. Her husband's dissertation is denied. They go back to Berlin. And then everything changes in 1933. Yeah, after the burning of the Reichstag, Arne says, I can no longer be a bystander to what's happening in this country. I have to act. And she is arrested by the Gestapo and detained for 8 days for what was called horror propaganda at the time, collecting anti-Semitic statements from the Prussian State Library. She was arrested walking out of the Prussian State Library on her way to meet her mother for a lunch. And the day after she's released by the Gestapo, they flee. She flees with her mother and she makes her way through Prague to Zurich to Paris, where she spends the next 8.5 years doing only work for Zionist organizations, helping to prepare Jewish youth to emigrate to Palestine, to live on kibbutzim and work the land. And then she's, in 1940, forced to report for internment. And she's interned in Gers, which is in the south of France, for 5.5 weeks. She doesn't know where her second husband is at this point. She's married her second husband, Heinrich Blücher. He gets set to a separate internment camp. After she escapes, she walks alone on foot to Lourdes to find Walter Benjamin, the 20th century cultural critic, who she was actually cousins with through her first marriage. And then she makes her way to Montauban to see if she can find her husband. And by chance, by pure luck, they run into each other one day. And with the help of Varian Fry, they were able to attain the necessary papers to emigrate. And Arne arrived in the United States on May 22nd, 1941. She was 35 years old. She had $25 She didn't speak English. And she would be a stateless refugee for 18 and a half years. She didn't receive American citizenship until 1951, the same year that she published The Origins of Totalitarianism. And so she really becomes this kind of public intellectual writer by accident, by the political circumstances of the century.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You lead me to a thing that I found that I liked in your introduction to the biography that you wrote. I wrote the quote down because it is about her writing and how she kind of became a writer, like you just said, by accident. And but the quote is, she said she wrote to remember what she thought, to record what was worth remembering, and that writing was an integral part of the process of understanding. I just, one, just really like that quote and that sort of approach to writing, you know, I think is great, writing for understanding's sake. But I'm also curious if you just like to expand on that a little bit in regards to even your own writing and Arendt's as well.
Sure. So for Arendt, all thinking moves from experience. And that's the frame that I use to approach this biography of Hannah Arendt, because I wanted to explore the relationship between the life of action and the life of the mind in Arendt's life. And so for Arendt, she says that writing is a part of the process of understanding. In her 1964 interview on German national television with Günter Gauss. And she talks a little bit about, I'll talk a little bit about her writing process in the mind. She talks a little bit about her writing process there, and she describes it as taking dictation from herself. So, you know, we go out into the world, we have experiences, we appear in public before others, we interact with and engage with the world around us, and we have experiences, and then we go home, we retreat into the private realm, we close the door, you know, we get to schluff, unbutton our pants, whatever it is, we get to relax, pour ourselves a glass of wine, turn on some music, but we get that sense of space that opens up around us, although it's harder and harder, I will say, with social media and computers and technology, which invade the private realm relentlessly. But when we retreat into the private, that space opens up where we can engage in this two-in-one conversation with the self. And all thinking, as Arendt describes it, is a form of conversation that we have with ourselves. And it's in that space of thinking that we can tell a story to ourselves about the experiences we've had in the world. And that's how we give meaning to experience through storytelling. And so Arendt describes her writing process as taking dictation from herself. And she would lie on her couch, her olive green couch in her apartment at 370 Riverside Drive. And she would smoke cigarette after cigarette. And she wouldn't get up and walk to her typewriter until she could write down what it is that she had already worked out, until she could take dictation from herself. Because she would retreat and engage in that thinking process and work through the story. Arendt was a storyteller. You know, often I was trained as a political theorist, whatever that means, and we talk about making an argument. But for Arendt, she's a storyteller. It's about the story. And so she would work out the story. And then when she had it, she would write it down. And so there was this dance between the life in public as a writer, as a public intellectual. She loved the stage, but she also needed the quiet to be alone, to be away from the world in order to do her work, in order to write. And whenever she was finishing her books, she would take herself off somewhere where she could completely turn away from the world. I think, you know, it's funny, if anything, I require even more solitude than than Hannah Arendt did. I don't know if that's a reflection of the 21st century and the extent to which we find ourselves instantaneously connected. You know, you're in Chicago, I am in upstate New York, and here we are looking right at each other on a on a screen and having this conversation. You know, there's a need for quiet, and that's certainly something that I need as well. I don't take dictation for myself. I do a lot of preparation before I write. And it's years often of, I'm finishing two other books right now, and it's years of reading and then note-taking, and then I write essay after essay that the world will never see until I get to the point where I can sit down and just write what it is that I want to say is not the right word, because I still, even at that point, discover a lot in the process of writing. But I will tell you that I wrote this entire book. I prepared as I do, and then I sat down, I wrote this entire book in a month. And then I wrote the final chapter, and I realized I had to go back and rewrite the entire book because I didn't get the tone I wanted for the book until I wrote the end. And so my editor was not happy. But I went back to the beginning and I wrote through the entire thing. So that tends to be much more my process, but I need distance. I need a lot of distance. I can never just take dictation and be done with it. I need to put it down, and then I need to put it in a drawer.
Let it marinate, if you will, and then come back to it.
It has to become foreign to me. It has to become something that I can approach that I'm not invested in, emotionally bound to. I have to be able to approach it as an object and not as something that's kind of pulsing with my own subjectivity. I need it to appear foreign to me so that I can actually hear it and read it as a reader and not just a writer.
Yeah, I like that. That makes sense. Because I feel like sometimes, for me at least, when I'm writing something, I'm so too close to it and too, that I can't see, like you said, can't see the, what needs to be changed or what is working or what's not. Getting that step back and I'm right there with you. Speaking of tone, I think it was maybe in regards to Arendt's early writing that she kind of used humor as a device to make her point, right? I don't know if you could expand on that, or kind of an ironic tone, I think is maybe what the phrase you used. Yeah.
Yes, Arendt had an immense sense of irony. She was often incredibly ironic and sardonic, and funny. I mean, she really was funny. She had this incredible smile and sense of laughter, needing to laugh at the world. There's a story that I often think about that she would recount in pieces of writing or in lectures about the philosopher Thales. So he's walking down the sidewalk or the street, and he's so caught up in the stars that he can't see what's right in front of his feet. And so he falls down a well. and then there's this little Thracian maid girl who's laughing at him. And I always think of Arendt as the girl laughing at the philosopher, and just the need to laugh. Of course, it's much more serious than that. And there are echoes there with what become her critique of why Martin Heidegger became a Nazi, because he was so blinded by his own philosophy that he was unable to see the world at his feet. Of course, that's her argument and we can engage with it. But for Arendt, laughter, irony was a way to create critical distance. Mm. She agreed with Bertolt Brecht that laughter was a much more serious way of handling a situation than tragedy or sadness or, God forbid, sentimentality. And it was also a way for her to retain dignity, in a world that often tried to strip her of her dignity. Irony was a way to maintain, she says, a sense of self-sovereignty, to be in possession of oneself, be able to laugh at what's happening. And this got her into lots of trouble when, as you might imagine, and perhaps it would get her into even more trouble today if she were writing about contemporary political events. I don't know. I don't think people have a very good sense of humor, you know. But she, when Gershom Scholem, you're laughing, so that's something. When Gershom Scholem wrote to her after she published Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, he says he wasn't engaging with the content of her argument so much as her tone. He says, "How dare you write about the Holocaust in this tone? This is wildly inappropriate." And Arendt says, "No, that's me. I have to, you know," she had to be able to retain that critical distance, which is necessary for laughter. And in that way, laughter can be much more biting, much more potent, much more critical than taking something very seriously and flat-footed.
Yeah, I agree with that. One thing, you know, like I said, we were talking earlier, like her writing is great, but then just her thinking is just like, she seems like an outlier amongst her peers of that time. Would that be okay to characterize her that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
She was one of a kind, and she was very much an independent thinker. And we see this in her writing. She is very anti-ideological. She's allergic to identity. And she is her own person. And a good example of this is the emergence of totalitarianism in Germany. Arendt was attuned to what was happening as early as 1929. And it cost her a number of friendships because people were not quite as aware of what was happening as she was. She was always, I always think of Arendt as planting her feet on the ground. She wants us to look straight ahead at what's happening in front of us. And then she puts another demand on that, though, a really hard demand, which is that we retain a sense of equanimity, that we be able to see the good and the bad, and that all of that is the world, and that we love the world onward.
Yeah.
But it's a radical demand to be present and in the now, to see what is happening in front of us and to say, okay, I'm going to love the world anyway. I'm going to love the world because, and I'm going to fight for it. That's hard. It's incredibly hard.
And yeah, especially now. just to keep laughing some more at it, but that kind of makes me, you mentioned it too, like, you know, how do you think she would be engaging with today's world if she were still around?
Well, I think that Arendt says at the end of her prologue to The Human Condition that my point is very simple. It is to stop and think what we are doing. And she says that we have to constantly be thinking the world anew in light of our most recent experiences, fears, desires. Arendt, if you look at the topics of inquiry, the kind of objects of contemplation, the things that she was writing about. She was writing about totalitarianism, fascism, evil, love, loneliness, solitude, technology, the rise of the social. These questions for Arendt were structured by the historical and material conditions of the 20th century, of modernity, of the time when she was alive. I think one of the reasons her work is so resonant today is that we're dealing with all of those questions.
Right.
Violence, evil, fascism, the loss of privacy, the rise of social media, the specter of technology, the changing shape of the labor force. But the conditions, the historical material conditions under which we have to engage those questions today have fundamentally changed. Our world has been radically changed by the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, 9/11. I think about the United States in particular, economic stagnation since the early 70s, what happens to antitrust laws at the end of the 70s, the century for a new America, the 1992, 1994. You think about the economic collapse, the changing shape of global economy. Mm. Right now, we are in a particularly volatile flux moment because the values associated with the political parties that I'm going to venture we both have grown up with are changing. Mm-hmm. And political parties have changed historically over time, but this is the first time they're really radically changing in our lifetime. And, you know, I think we're also witnessing the kind of collapse of the post-World War II liberal project. And it's very much being at least put on the table. And so we have to think about all these questions in a new way.
But I was thinking about, you know, like, it's about the idea of looking to the past, looking to the future, but maintaining in the present and kind of, yeah, I don't know if you could expand on that, if you know what I'm referring to there.
I think so. So Arendt says that to look to the past for analogies to understand our present moment is a mythological error.
Yes.
Right. And so Arendt very much looks to the past, but she's adopting a kind of Benjaminian approach to history, a way of pearl diving, a way of looking to the past to retrieve the kind of gems that can help illuminate something about our contemporary moment. So it's a way of doing history that is not historicism. Mm-hmm. So bringing the past to bear on the present without using the past like some form of Procrustean frame that we can apply right. to contemporary political phenomena.
Yeah. So it's like, I like that too, because as I was coming up with questions, one of the usual ones I ask is like, what can Arendt's writing, teach us about today? But then as I was thinking of that question, I read that part in the book, and it was kind of like, oh, it's not necessarily, yeah, like you said, it's not like a template or a filter that you can take from the past and put over our current situation, but you can find, different ways she's thought about the same problems we're dealing with, and kind of, like you said, like extrapolate that pearl from it, and then,
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I always say is that Arendt's work is not about what to think, it's about how to think. Arendt gives us a way of thinking self-reflectively and critically that forces us to call the conscience in the conversation so that we can critically engage with the social mores, laws, norms of the society that we exist in, so that we can hold ourselves personally responsible for our actions. And this is a very idiosyncratic conception of thinking. It's about expanding the imagination. It's about the quiet necessary for thinking. It's about allowing ourselves to come undone, to give up, to let go of all of those beliefs that we hold on to that allow us to move through daily life. I'm not saying that one ought engage or even should in this process constantly, you'd go crazy. But we live in a world with no shortage of injustice. Mm-hmm. And each individual person has to hold themselves accountable for what is happening in the world. And this is why in 1933, Arendt says, I can no longer be a bystander. I have to act. Right. I have to do something. Because what happens in Germany is that murder becomes legal, right? The whole moral structure of society is turned on its head. And so one can no longer count on the law to tell them what's right, what's wrong. No, one can no longer count on the kind of social norms of the society that they live in to guide their everyday behavior. They have to step back and hold themselves accountable because the world is, I was going to say off kilter, but I'm not sure that's quite right. But it's can no longer be used as that kind of moral barometer.
Yeah. Brings to mind her, like you mentioned earlier too, her aversion to ideologies in all senses, and you know, any ideology, just a blind belief in an ideology takes away what you were just talking about, is the net sort of necessary independent critical thinking, especially in a situation like 1930s Germany, when, like you said, what everything you counted on before is completely switched and can't be counted on anymore, then what do you do? Then that's where and she comes to the conclusion that I need to start working to help people, basically, who are, I think that's very important too, that we're still being able to have that conversation with yourself, and not just, I don't know. It seems much harder to do these days because like you said, you know, things like social media kind of impede on that private time, whether we know it or not, or whether we're aware of it or not.
Well, we constantly fill up the quiet spaces. You know, right. One of my favorite statistics is from the U.S. Department of Labor, and it's the annual time use survey. And they ask Americans how they spend their time. And Americans say on average that they spend about 17 minutes a day thinking. Now, who knows what what thinking means to each of these people who respond, but they spend about 3 hours watching television and 3 to 4 on the computer. Right. In addition to work, although now work for some is also on the computer. Mm-hmm. And so we are never really alone, disconnected with ourselves. We fill up all of those little spaces of quiet with distraction and noise. Yeah. Which forecloses that space of solitude and thinking necessary.
Yeah, that makes me think of, like, I can't, you know, how many times I just say to myself or to my friend, like, I just want to shut my brain off. And then so I just put on TV or something, but
literally does shut your brain off.
Yeah,
your brain enters into a meditative trance when you watch television, which, I mean, this connects to a number of the political problems that we are facing today, because people consume news the same way they consume entertainment. And so the line between what's real and what's fiction is continuously being blurred in our society.
Yeah. Again, I gotta laugh about it.
My students always say that I lead them to, like, the edge of a cliff. But you didn't tell us where to go.
Well, that's where you gotta get that around thinking going and figure it out, right? So I want to switch back to Arendt for a little bit, maybe ask some maybe nerdy writerly questions. But I'm curious if you mentioned some of her earlier, some of her teachers in the philosophical realm. I'm wondering if you had, because you also which again, I love the phrase you describe as a poetic thinker, so I'm wondering if you are aware of any sort of writers on the more poetic / fiction side that influenced her writing. Just curious, like, because she seems to be a very avid reader, so I imagine there's a lot.
Very much so. And so that phrase, poetic thinking, comes from her essay on Walter Benjamin. She says that he is a poetic thinker without being a poet. And so I extend the same compliment to Arendt. I say as a translator of one of Arendt's poems. And she, you know, it's interesting. So when, like I said earlier, when Arendt arrived in the United States in 1941, she did not really speak English. And she spent her first summer in the United States as a housekeeper with a family outside Boston, Massachusetts, to learn English. And I know this was, I'm gonna just, you know, say this because I think this was on your list of questions too. I think that Arendt's story, like so many American stories, is the story of a refugee who the promise of American democracy. And she was forced to give up her successful academic career in Germany.
Right.
And to flee. and to make an entirely new home in the United States. And, you know, she emigrated through Ellis Island in the spring of 1941, and she didn't speak English. You know, wow. She went to work as a housekeeper, and she to teach herself English. And then when she returned to the city, she went to go see the Jewish historian Salo Baron, who was teaching at Columbia University. And he offered her, he helped connect her to Theodore Herzl Gaster. And she began writing a biweekly column. But with his help, she was able to publish her first article in English translation, because when she started writing in the United States, she was still writing in German and having her work translated into English. And so then she started writing this biweekly column for a German-speaking newspaper called Aufbau, calling for the formation of an international Jewish army to fight the Nazis. And then she is able to secure an adjunct teaching position at Brooklyn College to teach modern European history. But during this time, she's also starting to work in publishing. And through publishing, she's starting to meet a bunch of American and English authors. And this is one of my favorite facts about Hannah Arendt, is that she really learned how to write in English from the New York poets. So Randall Jarrell would come to her apartment and she would help him with his translations of German, and he would help her with her English writing. And he introduced her to Emily Dickinson and Keats and the English poets. And so she really learned how to write in English from poets. And then she became very close with the American novelist Mary McCarthy, who was her best female friend in the United States. And their letters are really gorgeous, a testament to friendship and love. And another writer and poet that she became very close to was Hermann Brock, who wrote The Death of Virgil, which is a very underread novel that I encourage everybody to go read. And they had a very intimate relationship. Again, you know, sitting for hours, reading to one another, talking, working on articles and essays. Arendt wrote a poem for Brock after his sudden death in the 50s. And she also became very close with W.H. Auden. When Auden reviewed The Human Condition after it was published in 1958, he said as though he felt like it had been written especially for him.
Oh, wow.
And after Arendt's husband, Heinrich Fuchs, died, Auden actually proposed marriage to Arendt, platonically, of course. And she declined, but she really loved him. And they would spend hours together talking about, goodness knows, poems, I imagine, but drinking and smoking. And her trying to convince him to buy another suit and him refusing and insisting on his ways.
That's funny. She does seem like a very fun guest at a dinner party, I'd imagine.
Well, she was known for throwing dinner parties. So her dinner parties were written about in the New York Times.
No way, really.
The European intellectuals are in one room with the chocolate and the Coors. Uh-huh. The Americans are in the other room with the whiskey. And she would throw these huge New Year's Eve parties at 370 Riverside Drive. And Jerry Cohn, Arendt's literary executor, tells this story about Arendt, you know, jumping up on the kitchen table and lifting her skirts and singing Brecht's Mother Courage in German. So, you know, she certainly loved life. And, you know, one of the things that I have tried to do in my work over the past several years is humanize Hannah Arendt so that people can find their way into her work. You know, handing someone a 600-page book on totalitarianism is daunting, but when you start to get to know the person and you can add some of these details to their life, they become much more human and easier to kind of carry along as a thinking companion in certain ways. And I think Arendt's work is important and should be read far outside of academia.
Yeah, I agree. And I it's actually going to, that leads me to my next question. I don't know if you would like to expand on that. Why do you think that is? Like, and like you said, especially outside of academia, I think that's an important distinction to add too, you know?
Why so many people are drawn to Hannah Arendt's work today?
Yeah, and why would you recommend someone read her today?
Well, I think that Arendt is a good person to think with. In my experience, people who read Arendt for the first time either fall madly in love with her and become obsessed, or they hate her and they don't want anything to do with her. She provokes strong emotions in people. And I think that's in part because she's such a strong writer. She's really not holding anything back in the sense that we might talk about hedging one's argument or language. But at the same time, there's a radical openness to the quality in the quality of her prose style. It's about thinking with, it's a conversation. And so it's conversational. And you as a reader are invited to have the conversation along with her. And I think that's a very powerful writing technique, but I also think it's in the body of what she's doing. It's, you know, reading Arendt's The Human Condition is much more delicious, tantalizing, titillating than reading The Leviathan by Hobbes. It is. You know, Arendt's talking about Sputnik and the sun, the moon, the stars, and the work of poetry and condensation and modern worldly alienation, and why Karl Marx is going to be critiqued in this chapter. And, you know, somebody like Hobbes is going to be like, you know, life is nasty, brutish, and short. We must endeavor peace. Step one of, you know, 36. And so, you know, if you're walking through a bookstore and you're kind of looking for a way to think about democracy, to think about, Arendt is someone that you can, I think, with. Her language is appealing, which is not, I actually love Hobbes, and I think he's, I don't know why I'm picking on Hobbes today. Tomorrow it could be Tocqueville, who knows?
Right. Yeah.
But it's it's you know, I think that she wrote for a public audience. She was writing for the general public. And this is also interesting, you know, to think about the quality of her prose style and to remember that most of these pieces were published in The New Yorker. They were published in Harper's. And she was really writing for that kind of audience. And it's, I think, a testament to those publications that they were, you know, publishing,
yeah,
you know, three parts thinking, Socrates, you know, really schooling people in the reading, because Arendt is not easy. She's challenging. I've been teaching The Origins of Totalitarianism, I don't, for who knows how long. And, you know, right after Donald Trump was elected president, in 2016, this became a number one bestseller. People went out and they bought this book because they wanted to understand the rise of right-wing populism in the United States. So I'm teaching general adult courses in New York City on the origins of totalitarianism. They're overflowing. People come in, they have this 597-page book, which is really three books in one. They're like, I tried to read it.
Yeah.
Or they're like, I read it. But they're like, I, you know, what is this? And, you know, why is this the book that's going to help me understand what's happening? And so a lot of my work is translating in a way and making it accessible. But, you know, people reach for it. And there are those gems in there that can help us begin to think about, to anchor our thinking in something, that can, you know, kind of orient us to what's happening in the world around us today. But, you know, people are coming to these texts, perhaps having never read Hobbes, who's particularly important for the origins of totalitarianism, as it would be. And, you know, so she's, you know, I think a lot of, there are a lot of reading groups. Arendt creates community. Mm. That's, I'll end there. Arendt's work creates community.
I agree. And like you said, there's clearly a demand, maybe it's not the right word, but definitely a thirst for understanding, you know, where we're at now in our current politics. Like we already talked about it, you know, she already dealt with a lot of the, or, you know, not dealt with, but thought about a lot of the same problems, and then like gives us the framework and a way to think, which I think is important. Not what, like you said, not what to think, but how to think, which is a timeless thing.
We have to wrestle with this moment that we are living in right now anew. And there are many people that we can think with in mm-hmm. order to begin the work of understanding. And Arendt's one of them. And her work is, you know, I think it's the quality of her work. It's also her story. It's really an incredible story. She has this amazing education. She escapes the Gestapo. She escapes an internment camp. She manages to emigrate on forged documents. Right. She learns French. She learns Hebrew. She learns Yiddish. She learns English. She starts a new career when she's almost 40 years old. You know, this is it, you know, and her love life is also, of course, an endless source of, you know, conversation. But she's a fascinating figure. She's, you know, she's really, as Mary McCarthy said, she's a stage diva.
Mm. Which begs the question: how is there not a movie about her yet?
Well, there are two.
There are two.
I mean, so there's one. So one is a Hollywood kind of biopic, fictionalized mm-hmm. account of the Eichmann trial with Barbara Sacowa playing Hannah Arendt. She also did Rosa Luxemburg. And then there's a documentary which was put out 5 years ago now. I can't quite remember. By an Israeli director.
Yeah, I just looked them up. I don't know how I missed that in my.
That's okay.
as I was researching her all this time.
Yes.
Yeah, just a couple. It looks like 2012 it came out. The biopic. Mm-hmm. Yes. Anyway,
that sounds right. You can watch it on Criterion.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know. Well, I was wondering if do you have any favorite passages or quotes of Arendt's that you'd like to share? Let me give her the last word for this.
Oh goodness.
I know. Never,
I'm going to demur. I don't think I can. There are so many. There's so many to choose from. I will say that I have just finished helping to curate series of events on Hannah Arendt for the Goethe Institute of North America, and that will be events in many major U.S. cities, including a walking tour of Hannah Arendt's New York.
Oh, fun.
You will be able to listen to, even if you're not in New York City, and I'll be leading one of those in person, and there are quite a few Hannah Arendt events coming up in the future. And her poems will be published in November, December 2022 this year.
Oh, cool. When are those events happening this year as well? Or
yes, sorry, they are happening next month and
in
March. Yeah. So yes. And I'll happily give you the URLs for those
perfect.
So you can include them on your website.
We sure will. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. Was there anything else you wanted to share about Hannah Arendt or yourself?
I can talk about Arendt forever. So, know, no.
Cool. Well, thank you, Sam. Thanks for doing this with me.
Thank you, Nate.
Yeah. I had a great time, and if you come to Chicago for one of those events, maybe I'll stop by. So.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I hope we get to meet in person someday. And I hope you have a lovely afternoon.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers, their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.